Well, welcome back to night number four. We've got tonight and one more left. So thank you guys for coming out and for continuing to come out. Hopefully it's been helpful for you. It's been good for me just to go through it all again. And there's a few things as I was getting ready for tonight that I'm like, oh, I need to do that. Just in my own, you know, as it comes to my remembrance, it reminds me to do the things that maybe I've been putting off. So hopefully it's been good for you guys as a refresher or as new information, and hopefully it's been a blessing. So as a recap from last week, we talked about the seven baby steps. They're up there on the board. We went through, my plan was to go through the first three, and we touched a little bit on the third one, but we really only hit the first two, and we spent a lot of time talking about a budget and how to fill it out, and we kind of went through step by step, and I gave you guys, on your handout, I gave you a sample budget, and we kind of looked at all those things filled out. We talked about, you know, how to prepare for big expenses, you know, car repairs and, you know, use those sinking funds and kind of set money aside monthly in preparation for those things. Talked about, getting ourselves into a financial position where God can use us and, where he can, you know, where we're not hindering God's ability to use us because of the financial position that we're in. So, you know, if you were to sell everything you had, could you walk away with, you know, not being in debt and those kinds of things? And so the importance of being a good steward, living on less than we make, those kinds of principles that we've been focusing on the whole time. We kind of hit that again last week as we talked a lot about, you know, the debt snowball and how to you know, roll those things together and how to get some traction on paying off debt if that's the step that you're in. And so tonight I want to get to get into the baby steps more. So like I said, we didn't really talk a whole lot about baby step three like I planned on. But baby step three is just getting 3 to 6 months of expenses set aside in a savings account. And, you know, the importance of that just being, you know, having that cushion because, you know, things are going to happen. And so we want to be able to be prepared as best as we can. And so I put some stats up there. I don't think I put them in your handout, but, the average American, 78%, as of 2023, 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. That was up from 72% in 2022. So we know inflation is kind of hitting all of us. And so on average, about 8 out of 10 people are living paycheck to paycheck, just meaning, you know, the paycheck that comes in, you know, kind of already is going to be spent on things. And if one paycheck was to be missed for some reason, you know, or the paycheck was less than you expected it to be, 8 out of 10 people would be in crisis mode a little bit and not have, you know, a little bit of a cushion to fall back on in the event that, something was to happen, loss of a job or even just, you know, a medical situation that takes you out of work, or your paycheck is smaller for some reason. So that was, kind of a big stat, 80% of people almost. And then I put in there more than half of Americans making over $100,000 per year are living paycheck to paycheck. So like we've been talking about, the average income for Cass County is about $76,000. You know, and some people are like, wow, that'd be great if I made that much. Some people are like, well, I don't know how I could live on that little, you know, and we're all at different stages. But sometimes I think we think if we just made more money that everything would be fine. And a lot of what I've been talking about is, yes, earning more money in a short period of time, you know, to hit a specific goal. But just as a lifestyle, people who make $100,000 or more, about half of them or a little over half of them are also living paycheck to paycheck. So it's not just making more money. It's being intentional with it. It's having a plan for it. It's doing those kinds of things that are helpful. And then the median savings account balance in the U.S. is about $1,200. And so that, as we've been talking about, that's baby step one is $1,000. So the median savings account balance is $1,200, meaning half the people are less than that, half the people are more than that. If you look at just the average, I think it was closer to like $30,000. That's because a lot of people have maybe a lot of money in savings, and that kind of, you know, tips the scale that way. But half the people in the U.S. have less than $1,200 in their savings account, and that's a scary place to be, especially if there's debt on top of that, which in most cases we know that is the case. And so if this, you know, if this room is kind of an average of America, then 8 out of 10 of us are living paycheck to paycheck. A lot of us don't have, you know, any margin for error when it comes to our finances. And if we were to miss a check or if we were to, you know, have an emergency of a few hundred dollars, maybe it would be difficult to come up with the funds for that. And so, So, you know, obviously having $1,000 set aside in baby step one is big, and getting out of debt obviously is huge. But just thinking about like, the idea of baby step three and having 3 to 6 months of expenses set aside, and just the peace and the way that that changes your, stress level when it comes to finances. I mean, if you had, you know, if half of the people have less than $1,200 in their savings account, you know, how would their life be different? How would half of us, how would half of our lives be different if we had $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 set aside as a cushion? You know, would it maybe impact, the job that you take? Would it impact, you know, other financial decisions that you make? You know, like if you were to, if you wanted to switch jobs and you're living paycheck to paycheck, how would you do that? Well, you know, you gotta, or if you lose your job, you know, it's going to be very difficult to be picky and choosy about the kind of job that you take if you just really need something to get you through, you know, this week or this month. And so, the peace that comes from having that cushion of 3 to 6 months, set aside just in case, is huge. So, open up your Bible to Genesis chapter 41. This is a Bible study after all, so let's get into the Word a little bit. Most of you guys probably are familiar with the story of Joseph and his life. So he, you know, was sold into slavery by his brothers. He spent some time in jail. He spent some time, you know, he got fired from his job with Potiphar's house, if you want to look at it that way. He spent some time in jail, and then the interpreting of the dreams of the baker and the name of the other profession just fell out of my head, but the two guys in jail that he interpreted their dreams for them. Yeah, the butler. Yeah. I don't know why I couldn't think of that word. The butler and the baker, he interprets their dreams, and then eventually, you know, he gets to go and interpret Pharaoh's dream, and Pharaoh is just super impressed with him and puts him in charge of half of his kingdom. But I want to look at Genesis 41, starting verse 46. It says, "And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. And in the 7 plenteous years, the earth brought forth by handfuls. And he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. The food of the field, which was round about every city, laid he up in the same. And Joseph gathered corn as the sand of the sea, very much, until he left numbering, for it was without number. And unto Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of famine came, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God said, He hath made me forget all my toil and my father and all my father's house. And the name of the second called he Ephraim, for God hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. And the 7 years of plenteousness that was in the land of Egypt were ended. And the 7 years of dearth began to come according as Joseph had said. And the dearth was in all the land, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, Go unto Joseph, what he saith to you, do. And the famine was over all the face of the earth. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold unto the Egyptians. And the famine waxed sore in the land of Egypt. And all countries came into Egypt to Joseph for to buy corn, because that the famine was sore in all lands. And then chapter 42, verse 1 says, Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, Why do ye look one upon another? And he said, Behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die. And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt. And I'll stop there, and I'm not going to do a deep Bible study dive, but Joseph, in the times that there was excess, right, he knew that the famine was coming, and so he knew that things weren't going to be great like this all the time. But it says they were collecting by the handfuls. There was too much for them to even count. They weren't even keeping track anymore because it was just there was so much, and they set it aside so that when the famine came, when the lean times came, they would have enough. And the way that God blessed it, they didn't only have enough for themselves, but they had enough to sell and to give and all of that. And of course, God worked it, you know, in a miraculous way by bringing his family back together. And if you know the rest of the story, you know, the nation of Israel really is born during their time in Egypt because God allowed them to all be brought there under Joseph and kind of begin to grow as a nation. And so the point of that, though, is, you know, be a good steward of what you have. Like, you don't know when you might lose a job. You don't know when there might be a medical emergency. You don't know when your car might break down. You don't know when those things are going to come. So, you know, while we have the opportunity, you know, let's take care of those things. So I put on here that emergencies aren't ifs, they are whens. So it's not a question of whether or not you're going to have an emergency. The question is, when is the emergency going to happen? And, you know, how are you going to handle it when it does happen? And, we can go, you know, periods of time without an emergency, but eventually something's going to happen. Your roof's going to be leaky. You know, you just, there's all kinds of things that come upon us. And so, what counts as an emergency? I've listed out three things. There's some blanks in your notes for that. Something that's unexpected, something that's necessary, and something that's urgent. And so those are from, Dave Ramsey. That's the way he kind of categorizes what counts as an emergency. So, in my house, like we have a 3 to 6 month emergency fund, and, I don't think we've ever touched it. And we really try extremely hard not to touch it. That's not to say that emergencies don't happen or our cars haven't broken down or things haven't, you know, happened to us, but, we try as best as we can to not touch that emergency fund. But the rules that we've kind of set in place is if something unexpected comes up, you know, something you couldn't plan for, meaning, if you want to buy a new boat or you didn't budget for Christmas or you didn't plan for property taxes, you know, those kinds of things are not emergency fund things. Those are things that you should be planning for throughout the year or throughout the months to be prepared for those kinds of things. So something that's unexpected, you know, we had our basement has flooded, just a few years ago. We came home from a trip. I think we were home for like a day or two. And luckily for us, the flooding happened while we were home. And, so it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. We're calling the city. No one's answering. We're calling plumbers to come out. I mean, our basement was literally rising from, the drain in the basement. Water was coming in. And, so an emergency, you know, hits. That's unexpected. We were not planning on that. It was necessary. The water was actively rising while I was on the phone calling, anybody who would answer. And it was urgent. Like it was happening right then. I needed to get taken care of. So they came out, they jetted out the line. We had to end up getting some stuff snaked, and that damaged one of the old cast iron pipes. So we had to replace that. I think it ended up being like $1,000 total to get it all, fixed and everything. So, but, you know, as best as you can, if an emergency comes up, you know, obviously that's what the fund is for. But at our house, we try, if we can, to, you know, plan ahead for things. And we try to, if we have an expense like that come up and we can, you know, readjust the budget a little bit, maybe we don't put as much money in savings that month, or maybe we don't put as much towards this other thing. We kind of have to edit the budget on the fly. So, but the point is that those things just, there are things in our life that are going to happen. And so being ready for them, with this baby step three, you know, so like if, I don't know, your air conditioning unit goes out. You know, we're getting ready to head into the summer now. It's going to start getting hot, even though you wouldn't know it if you went outside today. But it's going to be getting warm soon. Your AC goes out. That's unexpected. It's pretty necessary, and it's probably pretty urgent, you know, if it's super hot outside. So if you're married, you know, between you and your spouse, you would need to decide at what point are we going to, you know, take out of the emergency fund? At what point do we think we can kind of cash flow this? You know, how urgent is it? Is it something, can it wait, you know, a couple weeks until we get our next paycheck and maybe we can just do it that way? All those things, you know, are kind of considerations. But the point is that to have, that account, that money sitting there protects you from if you're like at my house where we've decided we're not going to use debt for anything. Okay. Well, I can't go use a credit card to pay for something. I can't go borrow money from somewhere to use something. You know, I don't want to tap into a 401k. You know, a lot of people will fall back on, well, I've got my 401k. I can borrow from that, or I can use this credit card, or I can take out this personal loan or whatever, for this thing that comes up. And so, if you make the decision, like, I'm not going to do that anymore, well, some stuff comes up and you know, it's not realistic to be able to just have $5,000 sitting around for some large expenditure. So, you need to plan ahead for those things. And so that's what baby step three really, is there for, is to protect you from, borrowing against your 401k or borrowing money for something else and to use kind of as a buffer between you and life. And so, some people ask like where the best place is to put that money. You know, I don't have that much cash sitting around the house. So, you know, you just leave it in a savings account at your bank. You can put it in a high yield savings account. There's lots of those. There's lots of like online banks that have pretty good rates on that. So if you're looking for a place to put that, I would put it in just in a bank savings account, kind of separate from everything else. You don't want it, you know, maybe tied to your checking account. So you might accidentally overdraw your checking account and start pulling from your emergency fund just because you're not paying attention. But just put it in a savings account at the bank. It's not an investment. So you're not trying to make a bunch of money with the emergency fund. It's there just to protect and act as a cushion from other things kind of getting in the way. So does anybody have any questions about that before we move on to step four? Okay. All right, so maybe step four is 15% of your income being invested into retirement. And so this one I put up there, baby steps four, five, and six should be done simultaneously. I think that's a blank in your handout as well. So baby steps one through three, you should do them in order, one first, and then once you're done with one, you go to two. Once you're done with two, you go to three. And you don't do four, five, six, or seven until you're done with, you know, one, two, three in order. But once you finish the third one, once you've got the debt paid off and once you've got the emergency fund set up, baby steps four, five, and six, you do them at the same time. And we'll get into kind of why that is as we go through this. But investing for retirement is vital for building wealth in the long term. So this is the first step that isn't, you know, really kind of like an urgent thing. So the way Dave Ramsey talks about it is he talks about being gazelle intense, which I talked about that last week, just being super intense to get out, you know, cutting everything, working extra, doing whatever you can, selling stuff to get through those first three steps. And then once you get through that, he says to go from intense to intentional. And I think you should be intentional the whole time, but that's kind of the way he describes it, is just kind of flip that switch to not be quite so intense about things, but you're still being intentional about the way you're doing things. And I do want to kind of preface this this baby step with a little bit more of a disclaimer. So sorry, hold on. I don't know what I did here. All right, I don't know what I did with my notes, but with this particular step, so everything we've talked about so far, I think pretty much applies to everybody, right? We all should be on a budget. It's important to be intentional, to have a plan of some kind. Maybe you don't write every single thing down, but I do think it's important to have a plan. I do think it's important to have money set aside for savings. I know not everyone agrees with the completely debt-free lifestyle and not borrowing money, but that in general, you know, especially in America, not borrowing for every single thing, that kind of applies to all of us. Having an emergency fund, I think there's biblical principles behind all of those things. When you get into baby step four, when you're talking about investing, there's so much variance, and a lot of what I'm going to talk about tonight is maybe doesn't directly apply to you. We're all at different ages. Some of us have kids, some don't, some have grown kids, some don't, some, you know, some are married, some are single. There's a lot of variation in just like where we all are in life. And so, specifically with investing, you know, if you sit down with an investment, like a financial account or a financial, advisor, they'll ask you some questions to like figure out like, what are your goals? You know, you're saving for retirement. Okay. When do you want to retire? How much do you need to live on in retirement? You know, are you going to have a house payment in retirement? Are you going to have your house paid for? Are you planning on renting? Are you going to be, you know, how do you plan for an assisted living facility? Like, everyone's going to be kind of a little bit different when it comes to retirement, what that looks like. And so there's some variation here. So I think there's still some principles that are kind of the same for all of us, but I do think there's some variation. So I want to kind of disclaimer that at the beginning, because not every single thing for this particular step that I'm going to say is going to directly apply to each one of us, maybe in the way that budgeting and some of the things we've been talking about up until this point do. And so, so saving 15% of your income for retirement. So, I worked in the bank. I told you guys that. And so often I would have people come in that were living on a fixed income. And when, you know, with a, you know, $800 Social Security payment, and, you know, they're trying to squeeze out rent and they've got this and they've got to pay for their groceries. And, you know, it's just very, very restrictive and very tight. And a lot of us think about our retirement years, especially I'm not really the young person anymore, but if you're, you know, young, you think like, oh, in my retirement, I'm going to do all these wonderful things. I'm going to travel. I'm going to spend all this time with my grandkids, and I'm going to, you know, do this and this and this. And but if we don't plan on like how we're going to do that financially, how we're going to support ourselves in order to do those things, then it's not going to happen. And I don't know if Social Security is going to be there when I get there. I don't know if it's going to be there when some of you who are getting really close to it are going to get, you know, I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. But we can't really rely on that. We need to plan on our own for how we can get ourselves through our own retirement, you know. And so let's look at a couple of examples. Now, I put some examples in here of just some ages and some investment dollars and some scenarios just to kind of give us an idea of what we're talking about. So the first one's a 25-year-old. So if you're not 25 anymore, this is going to be a little bit discouraging, but hang with me because the point is not to discourage. But if you're 25 years old or thereabouts, I assumed making around $50,000 per year as a household. And if you're putting 15% away, that's $7,500 per year. That's $625 per month. Now, it sounds like a lot. But if you're out of debt and you've got a savings account cushion set aside, that's going to open up some opportunities. So if you're putting 15%, that's $625 a month that you're putting in. If you started with $0 in your retirement account and you put $625 in there from the time you're 25 till 65 and you average an annual return of 10%, that would be, you've put in $300,000. It would have grown $3.6 million. So you'd have a total of almost 4 million, like $3.952 million. And a lot of us probably think that would be great if I did that when I was 25. That would be really wonderful. But I'm not 25 anymore, and I can't do that. Some of the other things about this, too, is this is assuming that this particular random 25-year-old person doesn't get a raise over the course of 40 years of working. They only make $50,000 the entire time. And they just keep putting in the exact same amount. They never put in more. They never put in less. They just keep doing it. That's almost $4 million. I mean, that's a lot. If you're 25, it's great. If you're not 25, if you're closer to my age, I'm almost 40. So I put in a 40-year-old starting with zero for 25 years. So from 40 to age 65. For this one, I figured the average income, the 76,000 figure we've been working with, for most of this time. So 15% of that, that's $950 per month. That's a lot. Okay. That's like a mortgage payment, almost. But if you put it, if you're doing the steps, if you're trying to invest for the future, 15% is $950 a month. At 10% return, you will have put in $285,000. It will have grown $975,000. So you have like $1.3 million. I think it's, $1.26 million. Because that's pretty good still. I mean, it's not over if you're 40 and you don't have anything. This is assuming that you have $0. A lot of us, by the time you get to 40, have some kind of retirement savings. And so this is just assuming, again, no raises for 25 years, just consistently giving 15% to your retirement. And you got $1.3 million. And if you're following along with what we're going to be talking about here in a minute, by the time you get there, you'll have your house paid off. You won't have any debt of any kind, and you've got, $1.3 million bucks. You could probably live off of that, right? I mean, that doesn't sound too bad. What if you're over 40? What if you wish you would have done that when you were 40? So this is for a 55-year-old for 10 years, investing for 10 years from 55 to 65, also starting with zero, which, again, I think most people will probably have something by 55. Not everyone, but if they put in $950 a month, 10%, same as the 40-year-old person, they would have put in $114,000, only would have grown $80,000, so they'd have just under $200,000 saved up. So I told you I was not trying to be discouraging with these things. So what can we gather from those three things? I have three points. One is investing early, right? The earlier you invest, the better. So if you're young in here, start investing early, and it's going to pay off a lot in the long run. You can just see how hard it is to kind of catch up. The longer you wait, the more you have to invest. So the 25-year-old, I only had them putting in like $625 a month. These last two examples is $950, and they don't even come close to catching up with almost $4 million, right? I mean, it would take a lot of investment monthly to catch up. And so so the financial choices that you make today have an impact, a lasting impact. And so, you know, a lot of us think about retirement, at least for me, I still feel like I'm far away from that. And, you know, it's like one of those things, like, it feels like a waste to just put money away that for something, you know, I've always thought, like, Jesus is going to come back before I get to retirement, right? Like, so I don't even need to, I don't even need to save for retirement. What a waste. Why don't I spend that money now? But people have been thinking that for a long, long time, that I'm not going to put money away because Jesus is coming back. And those people have grown old, retired, died, and their grandkids are now, you know, so I mean, we can't just live based on the fact that he may come back before we get to that point. I agree with you. I think it probably will happen before I retire, but again, you know, we don't know exactly. And so, so investing early and consistently, the longer you wait, the more you have to invest, and then the financial choices that we make have a lasting impact. I did one more example just to give a little bit more encouragement to the 55-year-olds and to show kind of the disparity between how important the compounding aspect of it is. So, 55-year-old, if they worked 5 extra years, so they worked until they were 70 instead of 65, and they contributed $1,267 a month, which was 20% of an average income, they then would get up to a little, it's like $525,000 in retirement. So that's a little bit better. That's, I mean, you could live off of $525,000 if you had no house payment and you live kind of, you know, frugally. You could live off of the interest that generates. The whole reason that getting, you know, that nest egg saved up is so that you can live off of the interest. That's kind of the goal. That's you know, that's where you should try to shoot for if you can. So if you figure, if in this example this person has $525,000, if you lived off of 10% of that, that'd be like $52,000 a year. And you would, if you did that, you would never touch the principal amount in theory, right? I mean, there's taxes and there's some other variables there. But if you didn't have a house payment, you could probably live off of $52,000 a year. You're not going to be, you know, traveling all over the world every other month, but, you could survive. You could eat. You could keep the lights on. You wouldn't, you know, be struggling for your basic necessities. And so, the thing that I thought was interesting though, one of these, let's see. So, if they started at 55, I didn't put this slide up there because it's a ridiculous example, but I just wanted to point out kind of the craziness of the compounding. A 55-year-old who worked 55 to 70 and invested 100% of what they made $76,000 a year and they invested all of it. By the time they got to 70, they'd have $2.6 million, which is great. Obviously, you can't live off of $0, but they still fall over $1 million short of the 25-year-old who was just putting $600 a month in there, you know? So to be able to, I mean, you cannot realistically put $76,000 a year into a retirement account. They have limits. You can't even do that anyways. But even if you just put it in something that was growing, you know, into a mutual fund or something like that, even if you invested $76,000 a year, you would not even come close to catching up with the 25-year-old who just kind of consistently plugged away $600 a month. And I know if you're 25, you probably think $600 a month is a lot, and it is. But the power that creates over time really is huge. And so I don't want it to be discouraging if you're over, you know, 40 or you're over 55 and you don't have anything or a lot saved. One of the Ramsey personalities, I think it's George, I can't remember who says it, but I think it's him. He says that the best time to plant a tree was 25 years ago, right? If you wanted a tree for shade or you wanted to be able to build a treehouse in it for your kids, the best time to have done that would have been 25 years ago, right? But we can't go back in time. And so the second best time to plant the tree is now, right? So that it will grow and that we can, you know, reap the benefits of it later on. And so, they say that to, you know, kind of point to the fact that yes, it would be great if we could go back to when we were 25 for a myriad of reasons, but, financially, it'd be great if we could go back to 25 and do the smaller investment so that we have this, you know, long track and the money can multiply for us. But the second best time to do it is now, right? Regardless, I mean, we can't go back and change the past. So we gotta do what we can with what we can. And, they also talk about how, you know, if someone's thinking about maybe considering going back to school or something like that, they're like, you know, I'm 40. Should I go back to school and get this degree? I've always wanted to do this job and it feels like I'm past the point where, you know, I'm gonna be the old person in the class. I don't know if I want to go back and take these classes when I'm 40. And, one of the things that they point out is they say, well, you're going to be 65 one day either way, right? Like we're going to make it to 65, or I mean, if you survive that long, you're going to be 65 one day, or 75 or 85 or whatever age you're going to be. Do you want to be a 65-year-old person who took that job, you know, who took that those classes and got that job, or do you want to not be that person? So the idea just being like all of us are going to eventually get to an age where we want to retire or we no longer can work, and so that's going to happen for all of us. But do we want to be someone that has, you know, the money, the finances to be able to live, you know, a somewhat comfortable life or be able to do the things that we want to do in retirement or not? And so if we do, we have to make those decisions now in order to, you know, allow as much time as possible to pass and allow that compound growth to happen. And so it really doesn't, I mean, the amount of money you make obviously makes a difference on how much you can invest, but whether you make minimum wage or whether you make, you know, $100,000 a year or $500,000 a year, the amount of money that you make, all of us still need to be diligent and intentional about the way that we invest, because the way that the compound growth works is it, the more you invest, the better. But just having a system in place where you systematically do, you know, consistently invest, that has shown to be so much more powerful than just the person who, you know, who invests sparingly, or they invest, you know, every once in a while they'll throw some money in. Just doing it faithfully and consistently over time is huge. And so there's a verse in Proverbs 22, verse 7. You don't have to turn there, but it says, "The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender." And it's just a good reminder, that verse. Dave Ramsey quotes it a lot out of whatever version he uses. But the importance of getting out of debt and freeing up that income in order to be able to invest is really, really important. It's really hard to invest $625 a month when you have $625 a month worth of payments that you're paying on all these, you know, cars and those credit cards and student loans and things like that. But when you free those things up, it does free up the income to be able to do some other things. And so, so there's a lot of ways to invest. There's a lot of things to invest. Obviously, the most important element is time, which we don't have control over anymore. But I do want to talk about just some ideas of how to invest. So when people think about retiring or think about how to invest in retirement, you know, a lot of us, most of us probably have a job that offers a 401k or a 403b if you work in a nonprofit area. Or if they don't, maybe you're familiar with the term IRA. Do I do Roth? Do I do traditional? You know, I'm self-employed. What do I do? You know, there's a lot of variables and a lot of things. So again, going back to my disclaimer, a lot of this stuff is going to be situationally dependent, unlike how it was on some of the first things that we talked about. So there's a lot of options, and there's a lot of things to do. I'm going to talk about the 401k. The 401k and 403b are very similar. Other than the 403b primarily is for nonprofits, whereas the 401k is more your traditional, you know, a business that you would work for. So those are very similar, and then the IRA is going to be outside of that. So the 401 and the 403 are through your employer, and IRA is going to be separate from your employer. And so a lot of, you know, decades ago they had pensions. And does anybody in here have a pension that their job offers? Does any job offer a pension? You're receiving a pension, or you have a pension available to you? You're receiving one? Okay. Does anybody have a pension, the job that they're working at offer a pension? Most of them have gone away. There's still a few that are left. I know, like, the military, you know, if you put your 20 years in, you get your, you know, retirement benefits and things. So there's a few things like that that still exist. But for the most part, pensions have gone away and been replaced with the 401k or the 403b. In some ways it's good, some ways it's not as good. It just kind of depends on the person. But those are for the most part gone and has switched over to this 401k, 403b. So with the pension, you know, your employer set aside money each month for you, so that whenever you're done, if you work for them for 20 years or 30 years or whatever, then they guarantee your income for the rest of your life, or for the rest of you and your spouse's life, whoever lives longer. That's a crude way to say that. I'm sorry. It could be, yeah. Whichever one lives longer would continue to get the benefits generally. Whereas the 401k, you're in complete control, meaning if you don't invest anything, you're not going to have anything. But generally speaking, the 401k is going to have a higher rate of return. You're going to have a lot more flexibility in the things that you can invest it in. When you pass away, like, or if you and your spouse both pass away, pensions are gone. You know, those don't pass on to your kids. There's not a amount that your kids don't continue to get that money. There's not a lump sum that they get. Whereas like a 401k or a 403b or an IRA, when you pass away or you and your spouse pass away, that money then becomes part of your estate. You know, that money belongs to your family or your heirs or whoever you pass it on to. And so there's some benefits and some downsides, but the 401k, the switch to that really made it to where the employee has a responsibility to save for themselves because their job is not doing it for them anymore through the pension process. And so about, I think it was 2006, the Roth version of these 401ks and IRAs came out, which we'll talk more about here in just a minute. But so that's only been around for about 18 years or so, the Roth version. And so those are becoming more and more prevalent. If you have 401k through your job, I think most employers now offer both a 401k or both a Roth and a traditional in their retirement plans. And so, but a lot of this can be confusing. Like I hate doing taxes. I think I talked to you guys about that early on in this. Like I don't like how it all works. I don't understand it exactly. I mean, I get it in theory, but just, you know, having to save receipts and copies of things and what do I report? What do I not report? And there's just so many like things. How many people do I claim on my, my W-4 when I'm getting a new job? Like, how do I fill all this out? There's just a lot of confusing things. I think it could be a lot the same with retirement, with when it comes to, okay, do I have a 401k? I don't know. Do I do Roth? Do I do traditional? What's the difference? What's better for me? What's better for my job? Like, do they have a match? I don't know. Okay, they don't have very good options. Do I do an IRA? Like, there's a lot of variables there. And so I want to try and simplify it kind of as best as I can in the time that we have to make it make sense and to kind of point out the advantages and disadvantages. So the traditional, that's been the kind of standard since 401k started. Like I said, up until 2006, that was the only option. But that's pre-tax dollars. So the money comes out of your check before taxes hit it. And so it lowers your taxable income that year by however much you've invested. And so there's some tax benefits to that. The end result of that, though, is the money as it grows in your account, in your 401k, you have not yet paid taxes on that money. And so eventually Uncle Sam wants his tax money from that income because it came out of your check before taxes. And so when you get to 70 and a half, you have to start taking required minimum distributions. So you have to take money out of a certain amount every year because the government wants to get the taxes off of that. And so they require you to take so much out per year in order to be able to, collect the taxes on that money. The Roth, the newer one, the one that just been out since 2006, that one's after tax dollars. So you pay your taxes, your health care comes out, all that stuff comes out of your check. Then your 401k contribution comes out if you're doing Roth after all of that. So the advantage obviously is, or the disadvantage is you have to pay taxes on it before you get it. But the advantage then is that it grows tax-free forever. The taxes have already been paid on that money. So everything that, as the money grows, you don't have to pay taxes on the growth. And so, the examples, I'm going to go back to the examples that we started with. So this 25-year-old, same thing as before. The amount of money that they put into this is $300,000. The growth of it is $3.6 million. So if they do it as a Roth, right, they have paid taxes on that $300,000 and then they get all of the growth when they turn around and pull it out in retirement, they don't get taxed on any of that. So taxes on $3.6 million is roughly, depending on their tax bracket, is roughly $875,000 in taxes that they save because you don't pay taxes on the growth in a 401k or an IRA if it's Roth. So for a young person, I can't say for every single person, but for a young person, the Roth is going to make a lot of sense because it's going to grow a lot and you don't get taxed on the growth if it's in a Roth. Whereas the traditional, if this was all in traditional funds, as they pull it out, that money would be taxed. And so if they pulled out the whole thing over the course of their lifetime, they'd pay, you know, $875,000 in taxes, depending on their tax bracket. For the 40-year-old, they put in $285,000. It's grown almost $1 million, which in a 25% tax bracket is almost $250,000 in taxes that they would be paying on that as they pulled it out. So for most 40-year-olds, it still makes sense to do the Roth because of the growth, the compounding growth that's going to happen over the lifetime of that investment. And so they're going to save a lot more in taxes than they would benefit from getting it pre-tax early on. And then the other example, the 55-year-old, this is where it's going to start making less and less sense. So this person, this 55-year-old, only has $80,000 in growth. So again, that's about $20,000 in taxes as they pull it out at a 25% rate. So it may be more beneficial for that person to take the pre-tax option, the traditional, because it's going to lower their taxable income. It may save them more in taxes than it costs them by pulling out on the draw at the end. So hopefully this is not like boring all of you. As I was putting it together, I'm like, I hope this like makes sense as I'm saying it. The younger you are, the further you are from retirement, the more it makes sense to do the Roth in general. The closer you are to retirement, the less it makes sense. And so because of the tax savings on the money as it grows, that's where the big difference is do you want to pay taxes on the amount of money that it grows, or do you not want to pay taxes on that money? And of course, none of us want to pay taxes, but sometimes it's more beneficial to take it on the front end. Sometimes it's more beneficial to take it on the back end. It really depends on your age. And of course, it depends on how much you invest. I mean, if you're 25 and you really never put money in it, well, it's not going to grow very much, so you're not going to have very much taxes. So there's a lot of variables, and so these are just some kind of principles that, we want to pay as little in taxes as we can legally and maximize the money that we have available to us in retirement. And one of the great ways to do that over the last 18 years has been the Roth. And again, most jobs now offer it as a 401k, as a 403b. If they don't, you can do an IRA outside of your employer. The benefit, obviously, of the 401k is it just comes out of your check. You don't have to, you worry about it in that you set it up and all that. But once you set it up, you pick the funds you want it to go into. You don't really have to, manage it regularly. I mean, you want to check on it, make sure it's, make sure your investments are doing okay. But there's not a lot of, maintenance on it. Whereas the IRA, that's going to be something you got to go to a financial advisor or to a bank or wherever, and you're going to set this up. And then they can still do monthly withdrawals from your checking account or whatever. But there's just what kind of that one extra step. And so sometimes the 401k, as long as you have good options within that, is going to be kind of your best option. So I want to clarify too, I probably should have done this before I got into all this, is the 401k or the 403 or the IRA, whatever the thing is, that's like the vehicle that your investment is in. So you're not investing in a 401k, you're not investing in a 403b or an IRA. That is like the government recognized tax shelter that your account is in, or your investments are in. So you're actually investing in stocks or mutual funds or gold or whatever the thing is that you're buying within your accounts. So if you're going to put like this $625 25-year-old, they're putting that $625 into their 401k. That is not just, it's going in and it's purchasing something. It's purchasing stocks, it's purchasing mutual funds, it's purchasing, gold or some other, some other thing. It's purchasing something, but it's protected by the 401k or the 403b or the IRA. That keeps that's a tax, that's a tax word, or it's a tax, thing. It protects you from paying the taxes on it, or it protects the growth from being taxed. So when you're actually putting money into your 401k, you're actually putting it into, typically a mutual fund. That's where most 401ks are invested, into a mutual fund. So you get to then go in and pick, okay, what mutual funds. If you've ever done that before at your job, I did that at my job. I just asked when I worked at Commerce, I asked one of our financial advisors, I'm like, hey, what do I even put this in? I don't even know. And they're like, oh, you should put it in this and this. And I just kind of set it and forget it and then check back on it periodically. And then I'd have people coming to me, like my coworkers, hey, what do you put your 401k in? And I'm like, oh, I put it in this and this. And I had no idea. I was telling people what to do. They were asking me what I was doing. Within that 401k, there are most jobs, you have a lot of different options, some more than others. But picking the right mutual funds, picking the right investments within your 401k, is really important. So there's like something like 7,000 or 8,000 different mutual funds, in the U.S. that exist. And so some of them are obviously going to be better than others as far as how they perform. And so you want to make good decisions with those things, with the choices that you make. And so Dave Ramsey's got, oh, I missed a slide. Let's see. Okay. So Dave Ramsey has this recommendation of these four different types of mutual funds. This is on your handout as well. There's growth and income, there's growth, there's aggressive growth, and there's international. And so the way he recommends doing it is 25% into each one. You just kind of split it up evenly between all of those. If you've set up your 401k at your job before, a lot of times those, like growth and income, would be called large cap. Growth would be mid cap, aggressive growth is small cap. All that means is big companies, medium-sized companies, and small companies, as all those words mean. And so having your, if you just think about it logically, you know, okay, if I'm gonna put some money into the stock market, I'm gonna want some Walmarts, some Coca-Colas, some, you know, Exxon, some Apple, you know, these big, huge, like mega corporations that are just kind of pretty steady, right? They steadily grow year over year. They're gonna be pretty like slow, methodical. They're not gonna have huge variations up or down in their stock prices, right? It's gonna be mostly, you know, trending slowly up. They're going to be kind of boring as far as investing goes. They're going to be fairly boring. I mean, there's not a whole lot that Apple can do that's going to cause their stock price to plummet long term, maybe for a day or, you know, a short period of time if they have a, you know, a bad product that they release or something. But in general, you know, those companies are so big that it's hard for them to like completely fail or to lose money consistently over a long period of time. Mid-cap is going to be smaller companies. I had to look this up. Like, I'm like, what are mid-cap, some examples of mid-cap companies? I looked at like a couple hundred of them, and I'm like, I don't even know what most of these companies are. There was a few that I recognized. Five Below, you guys know the store Five Below. That's a mid-cap company. If you just think about like in size, like how big the store Five Below is, not the stores, but, you know, as a company, think about, I don't know how many locations they have. That's like a medium-sized company. That's a mid-cap company. There's a few other ones that I had on here. Roku. They make TVs and, you know, the fire sticks, or not fire sticks, whatever the little stick is that you put in your TV. So those are going to be like a lot of companies you don't even recognize because, you know, they're like a lot of, pharmaceutical companies and maybe things that you wouldn't even know the name of them. But those are like your medium sized companies. So maybe they come out with, you know, maybe a pharmaceutical company comes out with a new drug that like revolutionizes something and, you know, it takes off because, you know, this is some new thing and people are, buying a bunch of it and their value goes way up. But in general, mid-cap is going to be kind of a little more volatile than a big company. It could, you know, ebb and flow. You know, the CEO gets arrested for some crime. You know, that's going to plummet the stock for a little while. Like, you know, there's going to be some more volatility in the mid-cap. The aggressive growth, the small cap, that's going to be your smaller companies, you know, like, I wouldn't even recognize most of the names of these companies. These would be small companies that are still publicly traded companies. But they're going to be the most volatile, right? They're companies that maybe have, you know, 25 employees. These companies are either on the up. They're like, you know, they came out with a new product. You know, all these companies like Apple and at some point they all start out as a small company, right? And they had these ideas or these inventions or these products or these services that were so great and caused, you know, their stock to skyrocket, and they kind of moved up through the mid-cap and the large-cap. But the small-cap is going to be companies that are, you know, these companies could close completely, and you could lose the money, or they could really take off, or they could do really anything in between. So they're much more volatile. But you want kind of a good mix of those things, because if you just only do large-cap, you're just going to have kind of slow, steady growth that may not even keep up with inflation prices, especially, you know, inflation prices or inflation that's so high right now. They're not going to keep up with that. But you don't want to all in a small cap companies that, you know, are so volatile, you're checking it every day because you're worried that you're going to lose all the money you put in it, right? And then international, that's going to be any company that's, you know, headquartered outside the U.S. So, you know, those would be big companies, small companies, medium companies. It'd be a mix kind of all those things. But that's kind of a protection in case, you know, like if the U.S. economy was to go down, you know, steadily for, you know, if we're in a recession, as we have been, fairly recently. If we're in a recession, you know, maybe other, you know, other international companies are doing better. And so you kind of balance all that out. And you kind of have just a good mix of, I'm not going to put all my eggs in one basket, right? That's kind of the philosophy in investing is you don't want to put all your money in one thing. So you want to diversify it. You want to pick, some big companies, some medium, some small, some companies that aren't headquartered in the U.S. that aren't going to be as impacted, by our economy as these other companies that are within the U.S. And so that's a lot of information, but I know, like, when I worked at Commerce, my investment options didn't, because I was listening to Dave, and I'm like, oh, I should invest in these four different types. And I'm looking up growth and income. I don't see anything like that. Come to find out, those are just large cap. That's how my 401k had them labeled as large cap, mid cap, small cap. And my international options would be like European something or other, or Asian something or other, you know, and so they would have other names rather than these. So they might be called something different on your 401k or your IRA. But the important thing is to spread it across different types of things, different types of businesses, different types of companies that are kind of all across the spectrum. So you get a good mix of, steady growth along with maybe some exciting growth on these smaller companies. So I check my 401k maybe once a year when I get my statement. Sometimes I check it a little more often than that. If I get an alert that, you know, my online statement's available, I might log in and check and see what it's doing. Your 401k, your long-term investing, unless you're like getting really close to retirement age, you don't need to check it like every day. When I worked at the bank, it was super easy for me to check. I'd check it like every time I got a paycheck, I'd log in and check my 401k. And that's really stressful if you do that, because, you know, you're going to see it go, oh, I'm up, you know, $1,000 today, or I'm down $5,000 today. This is, you know, it's just like this roller coaster, and it makes you want to, if you're down, it's like, oh, I got to get out of this. I got to switch to something else because this one's not doing very good. But if you don't check it daily, or you don't check it monthly even, you don't tend to notice those things. But the stock market is up and down all the time. I mean, if you're checking it, if you just check the stock market in general, it's up and down all the time. Sometimes it's up more than others, but you're going to stress yourself out if you kind of check on your accounts too often. So just leave it how it is. Invest steadily. I gave that 10% return rate when I gave you guys those examples. And I hear a lot of people that call into Dave and they're like, you know, 10% is unrealistic. He says 12% sometimes. They're like, this is so unrealistic. You can't earn 10%. You can't earn 12%. And, you know, he'll throw back the statistics at him. But I looked up some stats today, just about, average returns. So the S&P 500, that is just, 500, company that's kind of the standard. It's 500 different companies, but it's kind of the standard that a lot of people use for gauging how well the stock market is doing. It's kind of indicative of what's happening on the stock market, in the stock market as a whole. So it started in 1957, and, I think I might have one more. Oh, no. Okay. It started in 1957. It's averaged since 1957 until today, including 2008 when everything crashed, including, you know, all these 9/11, these things that have happened. It's averaged 10.26% since 1957. And so, you know, that's why I use the 10% average return on those examples that I gave. I also read another article that it was on NerdWallet. They mentioned, so 8 to 12% is kind of an average return. So if you're thinking 10% is the average, you know, to give a little bit of a window, 8 to 12% would be the average return. They looked at from 1926 to 2022, so like 96-year sample size that they looked at, and they just looked at how many of those years, of those 96 years, how many of them made between 8 and 12%. They may have a guess on how many they think made, like for, you know, 1957 or whatever year, made between 8 and 12% for that one year. All but four. Okay, so Pam says 92 of them. Anybody else? 86. Only 7 years out of that 96-year sample made between 8 and 12%. So that tells us that, you know, if you're checking it annually, it's going to be pretty rare that you might see, oh, I made 10% on my investments this year, just like Luke said I might. You know, like that's going to be rare that that's going to happen. Only 7 times did it land between 8 and 12%. So 1 year it might have been 7%, and the next year might have been 22%, and the next year might have been 4%, and then 36%. You know, so it's going to be kind of all over the map. There's been years recently where we've seen, you know, 30, 35% increases in the stock market in 1 year. And of course there's been years where we've been down 8, 10, 12%. So the point of why I bring that up, only 7 years out of 96 times did it happen to fall in that one bracket. So if you're looking at your investments and you think, man, I only made 7% this year, well, don't look at 1 year. How much have you made over the last 5 years or 10 years? Those kinds of things, because it's going to give you a more accurate figure, because not every year is going to earn you exactly 10% every single year. It's going to be up and down. And so if you're not working with a financial advisor, or you're not consistently investing, you're just, you know, you're kind of jumping out when it gets bad, and you're jumping in when everything, you know, this person said this is a good time to get into the stock market, and oh, look, my investments are down 5%. I'm going to sell it all and move it to something else like gold or some, or cash or something that's going to be less volatile. That's not the way that you should view your investments. For retirement, you should be looking at them long term. Just as long as the track record over a period of years shows, okay, I'm averaging 8 to 10 to 12%. That's what you want to see. You don't, individual years are not as important because they're just going to be all over the place. You're not going to be able to predict them easily. And I mean, there's people who do it professionally that can't predict what's going to happen, 6 months from now, 3 months from now, a year from now, because there's just so much volatility in it. You don't know exactly what's going to happen. And so why is all that important? Why does it matter what kind of companies I put it in? Why does it matter how often I check it? Why does it matter what the return has been over the last 96 years? Who cares about all that? I say all that because if you go in and you check your account and you look and you see, I'm down 5% so far this year, since January until now, I'm down 5%. Well, give it another couple months and see, you might be up 5% or more. It's about being consistent and continuing to invest. If you look at it, let's say you jump in and you buy, let's just for easy numbers, so I'm going to do a math on the fly. Let's say you buy something, you buy a share of something, and it's $100 a share, and you log in 6 months from now, and now it's down to $95 a share. And you're like, well, man, I lost 5% of my investment. That you could look at it as, well, I'm down 5%, or you could look at, now's the time to buy more because I was happy to buy it at $100 a share when I bought it the first time, and now it's on sale for $95 a share. Now, I mean, if you think it's going to continue trending down, obviously you don't want to sink money into something that you think is going down, but it's like if something's on sale at the store, like you know, if it's something you were going to buy anyways, you should buy it at the sale price because if you're willing to pay full price for it, you might want to buy it when it's on sale. So that's why it's so important to work with like a professional on investing. Hopefully you guys are not taking my advice and like going to go change your 401ks tomorrow, or something like that. Like don't do that. This is kind of more principle and to maybe help you understand the way, that it works a little bit. But it's important to work with somebody. So Brenda and I have a financial advisor in Lee Summit. And so we sat down with him. He helped us set up, roll our 401ks from our old jobs. When you leave a job, you should, try to roll that 401k over. So there's a lot of things that a financial advisor can help you with. And one of the things is just to like remind you that everything's okay, when things aren't going good. And, of course when everything's up, that's when everyone wants to buy it, but that may not be the right time. So, just ride the roller coaster and just kind of be methodical and be systematic with the way you approach it. So I gave you some keys to remember for baby step 4. Work with a professional. When you invest for retirement, have a long-term view, invest early and consistently, and take advantage of employer match. So I didn't really talk about that, but if you have a match with your employer, obviously you're getting 100% return on your money as soon as you put it in there. So that's obviously a good place to start. Even if their options for mutual funds are terrible, to double your money as soon as you put it in, there's no mutual fund that does that. So taking advantage of the match. And then as far as the tax advantages, again, depending on where you are, as far as your age goes, when you want to retire, those kinds of things will determine, the best, Roth, traditional, et cetera, of where you should invest that money. Does that make sense a little bit? Okay, you don't have to catch all of it, but hopefully it makes a little bit of sense. Okay, baby step 5. So we're not going to spend a ton of time on this one. It's saved for kids' college. And so the reason we're not going to spend a lot of time on it is it doesn't apply to all of us. Some of you have kids that are grown. Some of you don't have kids. So, you're not going to save for kids' college if you don't have any children or if they already are done with college. That doesn't make sense. So, but for those of us who have kids who are still in the home, who are actually still children, the most common option for college savings account, it's called a 529 plan. There's some tax advantages to that. Anything you put it's after-tax dollars, so you can't do any pre-tax contributions, but it's after-tax contributions that you put in there. But every dollar that it grows is tax-free when you take it out. provided that it's used for educational expenses. And that's a pretty loose term. The way that it's set up is you can use it for a computer that you sometimes use for college. You can use it for room and board. You can use it for, you know, obviously tuition. You can use it for different things within that umbrella of education. So it's super flexible. And when I first kind of started looking into a 529 for my kids, my parents gave me a little bit of money and said, this was when we only had Jackson. They gave me a little bit of money, my sister a little bit of money, and they said, hey, put this in a college account for your kids. And I'm like, well, I don't have a college account for my kid. He's like, you know, a year old at the time. And so I started looking into it. I'm like, oh, 529, that seems like that's the thing that, you know, is the best option. But I started thinking, well, what if I put it in there? He doesn't go to college. You know, he's one. I don't know what he's going to do when he's 18. What if he doesn't go to college? What if he goes to the military and he doesn't need college? Or what if he goes into a trade and he doesn't have to go get a four-year degree for that? What if I went to Longview? I used A+, and Longview was paid for through the state through A+. So I got that for free. So what if my son does that? I don't know. You know what the plan is for him? Because it's so far in the future. And so I was a little bit hesitant to start one because I'm like, well, I don't put all this money in something and then he can't even use it anyways. And now, you know, then what are we going to do with it? But the reason I put lots of flexibility there, it's so flexible what you can do with the 529 plan. You can, so like if my oldest son doesn't go to college, I can just roll the money to his little brother and have twice as much basically for him to go to college. If neither one of them goes to college or doesn't need all of it or whatever, Brenda or I could go to college, or I could save it for my grandkids, or I could give it to a friend or a family member or a niece or a nephew, or like there's a lot of, you can transfer the beneficiary of it really easily to a lot of different things. There's like almost no limit to the things that you can, ways you can transfer it. And then the other thing is that they do is, like, let's say my son goes to Longview, he does A+, and you know, it's paid for, and we know he's only going to do 2 years at Longview and he's not going to do any more schooling after that. Well, you can pull out, if he gets a scholarship, so A+ counts as a scholarship, you can pull out money from the 529 plan equal to the amount, up to the amount of the scholarship. So for example, let's say Longview's $5,000 a year. I don't know how much it is, but let's say it's $5,000 a year and books are $1,000. He's paying $6,000 a year to go to college. And the, you know, A+ is paying for all of that. I can pull $6,000 a year out of that account without any taxes, without any penalties, to match the amount of his scholarship. Same thing goes if you got a academic scholarship or you got a, you know, athletic scholarship or something like that. So you can pull the money out a lot of different ways without being taxed on it. And so it grows tax-free. So it's a really great option. We have it for both of our kids. We have a monthly like withdrawal from our checking account. So they get a little bit funded each month. You know, every year the statement comes and we sit down and we just tell them, hey, you know, here's your statement. I don't get super nerdy with it, but the older they get, the more I try and tell them, you know, hey, here's what your money's doing. Here's how much we put in. Here's how much it's grown, you know, or here's how much it's gone down or whatever the thing is. And one of the reasons that we do that is just so they kind of start to understand how money works and the fact that we have a plan for them. But also it's partially just to kind of like indoctrinate them that like, you're going to go to college one of these days. Or, you know, you're going to do something beyond high school, whether it's, you know, a trade school or whether you just go get some certifications or I don't care what they do. They don't need to go to get a four-year degree. You know, from my perspective, I don't care if they do that, but I want them to know, you're not going to borrow money for it. We are setting aside money so that you have the money to do this. This last time, like in February, I think it was, because it was right before I started teaching this, the statement came in for the end of the year. So I sat down with both of my kids and I showed them how much they had. And I'm like, here's how much, you know, Longview, if you do A+, which I think you should, it'll be free. And here's how much MU is. Here's how much KU is. If you wanted to go to school one of these places, you know, you're probably not going to have enough money to do all of it. So maybe you could work some, maybe we can help you out. So, you know, just having those kinds of discussions with your kids, to at least let them know that like there is a plan. And again, not every kid goes to college and I don't care if my kids go to college, but there's a plan for them to do that. And if they don't use it, then like I said, Brenda or I can use it, or we can save it for our grandkids or whatever we want to do with it. So there's a lot of flexibility in it and it grows, like I said, it grows tax free. So, those are all, you know, great things about it. And so it's just kind of a nice option. So that's really all I'm going to say about it just because, again, it doesn't apply to all of us. So does anybody have any questions about Baby Step 5 college for their kids? Okay, didn't think so. Baby step six. This one I'm going to say probably even less about. Pay off your house early. That's right. I could probably stop with that. Just pay it off early, you know? Whatever you systematically can throw at it extra to get it paid off. The sooner that's paid off, think about the amount of money that frees up. If you could live, if you live with no house payment, of course we still have taxes and insurance, so it's not completely like there's no payments, but if you could pay off the mortgage, you know, that would free up hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars, depending on the size of your mortgage. That's a really big, milestone, right? And it sets you up for some, a little bit easier time, like in your retirement years, because you're not going to have that, you're going to have that one area of your life, your rent, your mortgage is going to be, stabilized. And so there's a huge benefit in getting it paid off early. But so the reason all these steps are laid out the way that they are, you know, obviously it's going to take a while. If you start, you know, with nothing in the bank and you're in debt, it's going to take you a couple years of working and paying off, depending on how much debt you have and all of that. It's going to take a couple years of hard work and cutting expenses and all of this stuff. And, like I said, I've said it a couple different times. The point of all that is not to get you to like, you know, live this, you know, terrible life where you can't spend any money freely and you have to work all the time. Like that's not the goal. That's the prescription to get, you know, to get to the goal that you want, which is ultimately to where you don't have to worry about the money. If you get to your retirement years and you've got, you know, $1 million saved up or 500,000 saved up or 4 million or whatever you have saved up and you don't have a house payment and, you know, you can live off of the interest that your nest egg, kicks out at you, that would be great. You know, I mean, there's not a magic pill to get, you know, this baby step or any of the baby steps done. This one will probably take the longest, right, of all of the baby steps. You shouldn't be able, you know, it shouldn't take you 10 or 15 years in, baby step two to pay off your debt. It shouldn't take you that long to save up, you know, your 3 to 6 months. It shouldn't take you that long. I mean, with, you know, in an hour, you can set up your 15% and your kid's college account. Those would be quick and easy things. But paying off your mortgage, that's going to take you some years, right? I mean, it might take you a decade or 20 years, 30 years, you know, if you just pay it systematically. So this one's going to take a while. But the reward at the end of it is great. I mean, I have not ever not had a mortgage except when I've been renting. I've never paid off a mortgage. We got relatively close with the current house that we're in now, but, as I told you, we're moving right in. We got close and then we're like, oh, let's start all over and get another mortgage, a bigger one on a different house. But the goal still is we're going to get a 15-year mortgage. We're going to pay that off as quick as we can, try and pay as much extra as we can to get, done with it as quickly as we can to free up that money and be able to, you know, get to baby step seven, which is to build wealth and give. And so, the less payments you have going out, the more money you have each month to do freely with what you want, the more you can invest for retirement, the more you can invest for, or save up for trips and whatever things you like to do, whatever hobbies you have, and the more you can give and, the more you can, just do fun stuff with money. And so that's the, you know, the goal of all of this is to kind of work towards that. And, this baby step six is kind of the last big milestone that maybe is blocking a lot of us, from that, but just kind of dreaming, you know, me and Brenda try to dream about like what things could be like if we were in this position or that position and what do we have to do to get there. So just having that kind of in the back of your mind, like this is a goal of, you know, we should all kind of have some goals, whether it's professional goals or goals with your family or, goals in your walk with the Lord or goals in, just life in general, financial, whatever. We should all kind of have, okay, what's a short-term goal that I can reach? You know, well, okay, I want to get this $1,000 saved up. I can do that. Or I want to get out of debt. Okay, it's going to take me like a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years, but I can do it. And, you know, so you have a little bit of a longer term goal. And then, oh, I want to save for retirement. Okay, that's going to be 20 years from now or 30 years from now or whatever. And, so you have these goals and these milestones. And these are just kind of, checkpoints that you can kind of, aspire to or goals that you can kind of set for yourself. But sometimes it's just fun to kind of think about what it would be like to be in this position. And, so that's baby step six. We'll talk about baby step seven, next week and we'll get into, I told you guys we talked a little bit about insurance, life insurance and, just some other things that we haven't done along the way. And then we'll have a question and answer next week. So maybe if you have questions that you've been wanting to ask or thinking about asking, plan on that. Yes, ma'am. All right, John, you're up. I gave it to the right person. He's right next to you. You didn't have to get up.
Sorry. So not trying to step on your toes, because paying off a mortgage is great. But from a real estate aspect and even a safeguarding aspect, it is recommended to always have something else other than yourself that owns your home.
What do you mean by something else that owns?
A bank. So whether you pay off your mortgage and put it in a trust mm-hmm. for your children, if you die, because you mm-hmm. will die eventually. But not only that, but also if you're younger, I used to work in real estate, and mm-hmm. so the ladies upstairs would always say, either if you're keeping a small equity line, something. That way, if you get sued, you don't lose everything that you've just invested in.
So I used to tell people that as well.
Yeah.
When I worked at the bank, that I would sell home equity loans and lines of credit, because yeah. that was what was taught to me is, if you have your house, because I would say, do you need a line of credit for anything? Or, trying to sell this home equity product. And they're like, well, I don't even have a mortgage. I don't need it. And I was like, if we heard that, we're like, oh, that's perfect. You don't have a mortgage. You're at risk for, fraud, some kind of real estate fraud. There's a term for it, but mm-hmm. where title fraud. Yeah. Thank you, Ron. You're at risk for title fraud, meaning someone could come in and they could, go to the courthouse and, lien record against your house, and they could do that, and they could try and sell your house. And so we used a lot of those same kinds of techniques, not the right word, but we would, sales tactics. We would use that same kind of thing as a way to sell people home equity products. Is it possible that somebody could put a lien on your house if you don't have a lien on your house already? Yes, probably so.
But I meant as far as like when you die, like putting it in a trust or something like that afterwards to kind of safeguard from that jazz. We had to deal with it with when our grandpa died. So
you can have a beneficiary on your house just like mm-hmm. you have on a car or on a bank account or something like that as well. You don't have to have a lien on it in order to do that. Yeah. I'm not saying that there's not some benefits in having a trust depending on the size of the estate. And you do want to make it easier for your relatives to deal with your stuff after you're gone. Cause if you don't have anything lined out, or you still have your, ex-wife on your mortgage or on your deed of your house, and that didn't get taken care of, and now you die, and now her kids get your house, and that was supposed to get, there's a lot of things like that could, potentially go wrong. So there is a lot of like estate planning ideas that are good, but having a mortgage on it or paying off your house doesn't necessitate or doesn't make those things more or less likely to happen. You still need to like have the right titling in place so that it goes to where you want it to go. Have a will, if you do a trust, have the trust actually own the stuff. That's one of the ways to do that. So that's a good point though. There is some advantages to having somebody else or having it set up the right way. So okay, so your homework for this week, April 1st is Monday. So I've been talking to you guys about doing a budget. Obviously, I'm not making anybody do anything. I'm not going to check your budgets. You don't have to turn them in. This is not a class like that. But if you're going to do a budget, if you want to try it out, April, is coming up in like 5 days. So it'd be a good time to get that started. If you're married and you're the nerdy person in your family, or in your relationship, you should get started on that now so you can then present it to your spouse and say, this is what I came up with. What do you think about this? Give you guys time to like go back and forth and figure out where you're going to land on those things. But we try to have our budget done by the first. I will admit it doesn't always happen by the first. Sometimes it's a little later than the first. If you have it done before the first, that's ideal. Cause then how much everything's going to be. And I mean, by the time the first hits, your mortgage is out, and a lot of these bills come at the first of the month. And so, a lot of your month maybe, or a lot of your money may be spent, pretty quickly if you don't, get on top of it early. So if you're planning to do a budget, now is the time to get started on that for April, because, it'll be here very soon, even though it doesn't feel like the month or the year should be a third of the way over already, but it's working its way there. So, that's all I've got. We are 2 minutes early. By the time I pray, we'll be on time. Let's pray, and then we'll be done for tonight. Dear Lord God, thank you again for this evening. Thank you for just the opportunity to teach on finances, God, and to just be wise stewards, God. That's all we desire to do, is to just do the right things with the resources that you've given us. And God, I just pray that you help all of us to be good stewards. I pray that you help me to be a good steward of what I have, and And God, we know that there's lots of things, and there's lots of ways to be unwise. And so, God, I pray you help all of us to just be intentional, be paying attention to what's happening with our finances, be paying attention to the things that we're spending our money on, because we know that we spend money on the things that are important to us. And so, God, I just ask that as people are working on their budgets for April and beginning to get ready for that, God, I pray that you would just help them to just be good planners and be able to go back and look at previous months, and God, just do the right things that you want them to do with their finances. I pray that if they're married, God, I pray that it would be a good thing for their relationship to be on the same page when it comes to their finances, and that it would not be drudgery, or that it would not be causing fights and problems, God, but that it would be a way to get on the same page and be unified and have similar goals. And God, I just thank you for this opportunity to teach this series, and I pray, God, that it is profitable for all of us. And I just ask your blessing on us as we go out. And again, God, just lift up this Sunday with Easter and just all the guests and visitors that are going to be attending churches all over the country and all over the world, God, that you would just use this weekend as a great outreach for the gospel. And just help us to be a part of that here at Heartland. In Jesus' name, amen.